Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the real pleasure of speaking with Christina Greer, who is the author of Black Ethnic Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Christina, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure to have you on and to have read the book. Before we get to the book, maybe you can share just a little bit about yourself, where you've been, where you are. Anything that you care to share about who you are?
Okay, well, currently I'm a professor at Fordham University at Lincoln Center in New York City. I got my graduate degree at Columbia University in New York, and I spent my undergraduate years at Tufts in Medford, Massachusetts, and that's actually where we open with the book. When I entered Tufts in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, I should say, I was part of the largest black class ever in the history of the university, which was roughly 3.3%, which shook out to about 60 students out of the class. And so that was my very first time actually ever going to school and being in an academic setting with other African-Americans, or what I perceived were African-Americans, and I later found out it was much more complicated than just sort of black Americans in the university setting.
And you begin the book telling that story about what I guess is essentially your first day of college. I wonder if you can just tell a little bit more about that story, that very personal story that begins the book, and how it sets up your motivation for essentially writing this book.
Right. Well, I mean, I was really excited to be in an academic setting with other black students. I had never really experienced that before. I went to private schools my whole life in Philadelphia and then in Illinois, and so I had never really had that experience. And so when we went to Cape Cod for a weekend, an optional weekend, which I chose to do, as did several students, there was a question by one of the moderators where he asked us to close our eyes and raise our hands if our parents told us when we got to college not to get wrapped up with the black kids, which I thought was a really odd question because I was so eager to get wrapped up with the black kids when I went to college. And I saw that the vast majority of people had their hands raised, but those students were also of African and Caribbean descent. And so even though we were all sort of very close in different capacities, and we were all part of the Black Student Association, or at the time it was called the Pan-African Alliance, those students also had a dual membership in the Caribbean Club and also the African Students Association, as well as a membership in the Black Student Association. So they had this sort of race and ethnic narrative that I really hadn't investigated before.
And that's what makes up much of the book. And this wasn't just, you're telling a story. It isn't just about your own personal experience, though that animates much of the book. You also comment on the very limited literature that exists in a number of different fields, not just political science, on African and Afro-Caribbean politics.
Right.
You note that there have been these great breakthroughs in Latino and Asian American research, there's still, sort of limitations. I wonder if there's any specific pieces of that literature that you drew heavily in approaching your subject matter. That is recent research on Latinos or Asian Americans that you brought to your subject matter.
Right. Well, I mean, the scholars who were sort of leading the charge with Asian American political science research, Jane Jung, Karthik Ramakrishnan, Teku Lee, Natalie Masuoka. I mean, these are scholars that are taking the qualitative and quantitative work and moving it forward in ways that we've just never seen before. Someone like Rudy de la Garza or Luis DeCipio for Latino politics. I relied heavily on Rudolph Rogers' work because he's one of the main political scientists who looks at Afro-Caribbeans and black Americans, because much of the African-American literature essentially presumes that when they say African-American, that we're just talking about black people who were descendants of U.S. slavery, who've gone through the Great Migration from south to north. And even if they aren't assuming that, they're never explicit about who they're talking about. Are they talking about first generation, second generation? The countries are so varied across the Caribbean and across Africa. So when I looked at Ruel Rogers' work, he has some fantastic qualitative research, but no quantitative research in the book that that I largely lean on. So I wanted to have not only qualitative and quantitative work in conversation with one another, but what about this new, relatively new, but very growing African population? So what would happen if we made it a tripart story as opposed to just a bipart story between Afro-Caribbeans and Black Americans? What if we added in Africans? And would that change some of the theories that these sociologists, mainly from the CUNY system, you know, I'm thinking of Phil Kasnitz and Nancy Foner and John Mollenkopf, who's actually a political scientist, you know, Mary Waters at Harvard, like, if we added in a quantitative perspective as well as Africans, would that change some of these theories that they've spent many years sort of negotiating?
You refer throughout the book to Black ethnics, and you refer as to the group as an elevated minority,
mm-hmm.
but not as a model minority.
Right.
What do you mean by drawing this distinction between these two terms?
Well, you know, oftentimes when we've heard the term model minority, it refers to Asian Americans for the most part. And what I found in my qualitative interviews is that so many African and Caribbean respondents didn't want to be, quote-unquote, in last place, which means in, say, a racial hierarchy, they're recognizing that Black Americans are perceived to be on the bottom. That's why they are oftentimes choosing not to become American. They'd rather stay immigrant, because for them to become American, they have to become Black American. And so even though many whites that we interviewed, that I interviewed, say, and, you know, and other scholars have looked at this as well, they say, oh, I can't really tell the difference. But once they do sort of figure out that someone's from the Caribbean or from Africa, there are a lot of assumptions that are made about a better work ethic, a higher level of dedication to either professionalism or to their schoolwork. So those Black immigrants, or those Black ethnics, not Black Americans, but Afro-Caribbeans and Africans, are seen as better than Black Americans, but obviously not as good as Asians. So that's where I came up with the term an elevated minority, in the sense that they'll never be on the status of a model minority, which is largely reserved for Chinese and Japanese and Korean students for the most part, and South Asian students and individuals, but they're still elevated among above Black Americans.
Yeah, you've alluded a little bit to some of the methodological approach that you've taken, but I wonder if you could go into a little more depth about particularly which data you use. And how you go about using it. It seems like one of the big contributions to the field is some of the novel data that you had access to and the way in which you incorporated it into this subject matter. So what did you look at?
Right. Well, I actually created my own data. You know, I started this project in graduate school, as many social scientists do, you know, and ultimately my dissertation became the book. And I mean, the funny story about that is, you know, there's, you know, the National Black Election Study, which is a huge comprehensive study that has African Americans, complete oversample of African Americans, you know, over the span of, I think now, 15 years. You know, there's the National Election Study and the General Social Services Survey. And so these are all data sets that political scientists rely on consistently. But as I combed through the National Black Election Study, I could not find an ethnicity question, which, you know, as a graduate student, I just assumed, okay, well, I just need to look a little closer. It's obviously there, right? I mean, the people who put this survey together are some of the most, you know, sort of tedious, you know, sort of, they are some of the leading Black scholars in the discipline. So clearly there's an ethnicity question, right? Clearly they have thought to put this in there. And the day that I essentially printed out the entire code book, you know, I searched it, you know, control F first, and then I said, you know what, I'm not finding it. It has to be here. So when I printed it out, I literally went page by page throughout the code book and realized that Black scholars had not put in an ethnicity question. Would you let me know? We clearly know that there's diversity within the Black population in the United States, but there's something about political science literature that just has not thought to recognize it. And so, you know, later on there's some studies in Michigan that have looked at Caribbeans and Blacks, but again, no Africans. So I actually looked at a union population in New York City, largely because I knew the president at the time, and he said that I could have access to the 18,000 members who were largely Black and Latino. So I did an oversampling of those members, and I wanted to use a union population just because I knew I could get controls for class. So I knew that the labor population had a very diverse sort of, they have a very diverse white ethnic population, they have a diverse black ethnic and Latino ethnic population. But for the most part, I wanted to make sure I wasn't looking at doctors and refugees and nannies and cab drivers and having some of the class distinctions actually interfere with my racial and ethnic analyses. So in that sense, I used an original survey that I created with about 450 participants, and then I also compared that with pooling together years of the national elections survey and the national election study and the general social survey.
And you're then, as a result, able to disaggregate into some categories that typically are too small.
Right, exactly.
To really think and generalize about.
And then I also interviewed members of the union so that I could help explain some of my local and national data. So I had, you know, quotes from people saying how they felt, you know, or how they feel interacting with other blacks not in their ethnic group.
Now, much of this is about public opinion and public attitudes that differ in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could maybe just talk a little bit about maybe just something you expected in one of these categories of public opinion, and maybe a finding that then surprised you, that differences showed up where you didn't expect differences or where you expected big differences, none ended up appearing.
Right. Well, I mean, I thought... What I initially hypothesized, and this is in the conversation about the American dream, I initially hypothesized, and I fundamentally believe that the longer blacks were in the United States, the less likely they would be to subscribe to the American dream. And so because of that, we know that there have been, you know, black Americans, and those are the people I classify as, you know, descendants of U.S. slavery, essentially ninth-generation Americans, and then Afro-Caribbeans who've been here, you know, largely since, you know, say the 1920s, and then, you know, migration in the 1960s, and then Africans, who are sort of the newest arrived group of individuals, you know, largely from either the 60s or primarily the 1980s. So I thought we would see, let's just say we put it on a spectrum, that black Americans would be the least invested, Afro-Caribbeans would be someplace in the middle, and then Africans would be the greatest invested in the American dream. And what I found was that Africans are indeed the most invested in the American dream, and what, you know, through my qualitative interviews, it's because many of them don't feel like they have an exit option, or what Will Rogers calls, you know, the exit option, where you can ever move back to your home country. You might go to visit, you might send remittances, but to actually live there is probably not an option for many people, so they're invested in making it work. What I found, though, with black Americans is that they were the middle group, and Afro-Caribbeans were the least likely to believe in the American dream. And so through my qualitative interviews, I found that speaking to black Americans, they essentially adopted the attitude of, you win some, you lose some, right? You could have a son that goes to Harvard, or you could have, you know, a daughter who ends up in the prison industrial complex. You know, you could have a cousin who's on welfare, and you could also have a cousin who's the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. So black Americans were essentially in the interview saying, well, there's certain things that are in our control. There are many things that aren't. So you just kind of work hard, and that's kind of what happens in this country. It's a toss-up. Whereas Afro-Caribbeans, through the interviews, really felt frustrated in the sense that they felt like they came here to work hard, but they're seeing that other immigrants who don't have black skin have certain opportunities afforded to them because they're not black in any way, shape, or form. And so they're the least likely to feel like the American dream is actually what it's promised to be.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this relates to where you did your study in New York City. I wonder if you thought at all, and it's not in the book, but I wonder if you thought at all about what this study would look like if you were looking at, let's say, South Florida, which
right.
is in some ways newer, but established Afro-Caribbean communities or other parts of the country. What part of this can we attribute to the uniqueness of New York City, and which part of this is unique to just the interactions that you're describing related to ethnic groups?
Right. Well, I mean, I thought about that quite a bit, right, because I was trying to find another city that had a significant population of Africans and Caribbeans and black Americans. And what I'm finding is that many cities, like Chicago, has a very large growing African population, but not a very large Caribbean population. Whereas D.C. has a growing African population, but not a large Caribbean population. So, you know, whereas South Florida, very large Caribbean population, not so much with Africans. So I think, you know, I think we might find something slightly different as far as just perceptions of who works hard, residential segregation, who sort of gets, who has better relationships with whites. But I think, you know, in just some of the academic conversations I've had with individuals who live across the country, I think that, and you know, and also comparing it to national data, which is Africans and Caribbeans and Black Americans from across the country, granted it's pooled over years, but that data sort of mirrors very nicely the New York data. So I think that we can actually use this, if not as an extrapolation full stop, but as a launching period or a launching point so that we can better ask these questions in the future. So what I say in the book often is that, listen, I'm the first person who's just sort of trying to crack this code with these three very important groups. I'm welcoming more people to sort of do these studies. You know, what does Dallas look like? I mean, Dallas doesn't have a large Caribbean population, but they have a very large growing African population. You know, what do these new cities look like as new groups of blacks are trying to negotiate not just their political identity, but we know it's a lot more complicated when they're perceived scarce resources. I always say perceived scarce resources because we know that this country always finds resources when they want to find resources for who they want to find them for. So when it's perceived scarce resources, what does that do to intra-racial relationships between blacks, Caribbeans, and Africans as they all fight not to be in last place?
Yeah, I enjoyed the book a lot. I think there's just so much new stuff to learn here, and your approach is so balanced and multi-method. It really does add a lot to not just the study of immigrant politics, but also many other aspects of American politics. What's next from you? Do you have a follow-up book project? Is it going to be in this same realm, or is there something new on your desk for this fall?
What's new on my desk is actually a brand new book, but I actually am moving away from the immigrant narrative for now, just because I didn't want to be pigeonholed as sort of the race immigration lady. And so doing the historical background research on why it is people come to the United States, I sort of got a little more involved in the historical aspects of American political development. So my second project is actually on all the African Americans who have run for the presidency or been nominated for the presidency from 1872 to 2008. And it's largely about symbolic candidates and alternative parties. The vast majority of these individuals, roughly 60, about 75% ran on alternative parties, so a third party that's not a Democratic or Republican ticket. And they were seen as symbolic candidates. You know, obviously they would, quote-unquote, never win, and their campaigns were largely seen as failures, in some cases as a joke. And so I started to look a little deeper, and I realized that roughly 40% of these 60 individuals were women. So why would a black woman in the 1960s or the 1970s or 80s even, during the Reagan era, why would they even run for the presidency? And so what I'm finding is that these third parties, you know, who were seen as these useless candidates that were just, you know, trying to make a name for themselves and not really contributing anything to the polity, actually did some really great things for introducing blacks into political participation, right? They helped register people to vote. They helped bring up single issues that got people into sort of politics in some way, shape, or form. They helped raise money. And so when their campaigns ultimately, quote-unquote, failed, and I don't like to see them as failures, well, you've already pulled in, even if it's only 5,000 black people, you've pulled in 5,000 black people who were actually participatory. And if you think about the length of time that African Americans have been politically active as a large group, it's actually not that long. I mean, keep in mind, the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act of 64 and 65 are, you know, not too long ago. I mean, my mother was in college during that time period. So it's not like African Americans have had the franchise full stop for a very long time. So I'm looking at the significance of these quote-unquote failures and how they've actually contributed to what many argue is the greatest golden prize ever, which is to have an African American president in the White House.
Yeah, well, I look forward to that. And for all of those that are interested in Christina's current book, Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream, that was published this year by Oxford University Press. It's available widely. Christina, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.